I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Events over the past year have shone a light on racial inequality across the globe. Australia is no exception. This nation's journey towards a more just, equitable and reconciled identity still has a long way to go. With that in mind, and in a spirit of reconciliation, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and community. We pay our respects to elders past, present and emerging, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people today.
I ask the Prime Minister,
how good is Australia?
Please explain.
Life is changing in Australia
because the pub is shut.
Sucked in, fellas.
I actually find it gobsmacking.
I will call it a personal nightmare.
Tell the Prime Minister to go and get...
It is changing all around the world.
I accept your nomination.
The authority is total.
And I rejected that approach.
It's all about acknowledging how far we've come.
He's all tip and no iceberg.
Like a really scary wooden puppet.
He was drunk.
That's not true.
Not now, not ever.
You're a classic space invader.
A social climbing sycophant. You should be ashamed of yourself.
Oh, fair shake of the sauce bottle, mate.
Taste of democracy, very good.
Welcome to Democracy Sausage. I'm Virginia Marshall, and I've temporarily taken over the tongs for Mark Kenny. So what do? Well, lately I've been researching a whole range of issues that deal with the rights of nature, continuing my work as the leading scholar on Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander water rights and sea rights, and also really looking into an understanding for researchers using Indigenous knowledge and the ethics around those issues. And I'm also the inaugural ANU Postdoctoral Indigenous Fellow at the School of Regulation and Global Governance and the Fenner School of Environment and Society at the ANU. I'm a Wiradjuri Nyemba woman from New South Wales and very keen to talk with very interesting and amazing people in our community. There are many, and as we know, today's guest is going to be a very special conversation. Democracy Sausage is produced by the Crawford School of Public Policy and the Australian Studies Institute at the School of Politics and International Relations at the Australian National University. So today we're going to have an interesting guest on the podcast, and we're going to have a yarn with Peter Yu. And we'll be talking about a whole range of issues, such as Peter's incredible advocacy over his life and his lifetime as a Yawuru man, and what that means to him and the meaning of country, and also exploring some of the issues that he's now tackling, which is really leading a First Nations body, a hub, which is really essential for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. And we're going to find out why that is and what is there yet to be done. Professor Peter Yu, AM, is a Yawuru man from Broome in the Kimberley region in northwest Australia. Peter has over 40 years of experience in Indigenous development and advocacy in the Kimberley and at the state, national and international level. Peter is a key negotiator on behalf of the Yawuru native title holders with the Western Australian State Government over the 2010 Yawuru Native Title Agreement. And also, Peter is the current and inaugural Vice President First Nations at the Australian National University. Now is a time to have a yarn with Peter, and let's get chatting. Hi, Peter. Welcome to Democracy Sausage.
Hi, Virginia. Thanks for inviting me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. And really, it's also an honour because sitting with such an amazing person that has had and fulfilled so many different roles over your lifetime, I guess what most people sitting here in their comfy chair today would like to know, what's the meaning of country mean to you? You know, your earliest memory of understanding yourself as a Yarru person and the environment around you. When do you have that recollection?
Clearly there's an inbuilt and inherent understanding where you're born, on your country, who your people are, what you do. But I think for a lot of us growing up in a post-colonial environment, there's also a degree of confusion because of the particular legislative and regulatory kind of regime, racist regime that governs you and your family's life. I mean, you know, where I come from, I'm from Broome, which is, you can tell by my surname, my mother is Yarru. My father, you know, was a Chinese pearl diver coming to work in Broome like many Asian indentured labour before and after the Second World War. I grew up with my grandfather and my Aboriginal family, you know, and we are saltwater people. So basically our entire lives were spent largely fishing and sustaining ourselves through that way in the intertidal zone. So as saltwater people do, you live off the ocean, you fish, you hunt, you gather, you share with your family. There was never really any considered thought about what it is you did, because that was the way life was. That's what you learned from your grandparents, from your parents, from your, you know, all your extended families. It was not something you questioned. What you questioned was really what the nature of the overarching political and legislative regime that controlled your family lives. Many people may not be familiar, but the 48 apartheid laws in South Africa, of course, came from Australia, you know, and that affected my family directly in terms of my mother coming, you know, on third generation Catholic mission, my grandmother being a stolen generation person. She's a Bunuba woman from Fitzroy Crossing, have been brought to Beagle Bay Mission, some, you know, 500 kilometres towards the coast. My mother having been taken off her parents and, you know, and brought up in a dormitory situation on the Catholic mission. I think that we were caught the edge of my generation of being sent away to a mission school in Perth at a very young age, about, you know, 11 years old. At the same time, you know, things like my mother and father were not allowed to marry. It was against the law to cohabit with a native, as it was in those days, with a penalty of, I think it's about, if I recall, about £30. You know, I remember my father mentioning a number of times he probably had to pay that under the table to the cops or somebody so that he didn't, you know, get arrested, as would many other Asian people in relationship with Yarru and other local cultural groups, women. Broome is different because they tried to turn a blind eye to the White Australia policy because they needed the Asian and indentured labour there to be able to harvest the pearl shell and the pearl to provide all of the kind of, you know, the very hard labour work that needed to be done, because the whitefellas found it difficult to work in that environment. So, you know, when you ask about what does country mean, country means, you know, your cultural connection to your family, to your people. We weren't allowed to speak our language at school, and generally, you know, you had the dog ticket, as the old people called it, which was basically the only way that you could engage in a broader community was to apply to become a citizen, which basically meant you became an honorary white. So you weren't allowed to mix with your family, speak your language, you know, to receive those defined them as benefits, but who knows. The country means that there is the cultural and spiritual connection, but the country also means your lived experience at any particular time of any particular era that affects and influences the way you view the world and the way that you interact with that world and the way you view others. And so I guess that's a fairly long way of explaining it, but I think it's important to understand there are those effects and influences that we've all had in our experiences in life, and it's important to understand, you know, how all of those components are made up.
And a lot of those difficult times, as you mentioned, and that's also shared by many Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people across this nation, but also was there a time, like many of us, where you had that moment, I guess other people might call it an epiphany, but also when you were then in Perth, you're at a Western structured school. When did the lights go on that Western education was very different than Aboriginal education?
Well, it's a strange experience. I don't know, because I think I was educated by the Catholics. You know, first of all by the Catholic nuns, Saint John of God nuns, and then later on by the Christian Brothers. And in the middle of that, you had the German Catholic Order of Priests, who ran the missions in the Kimberleys and in the south, the Palatine Order. So it was obviously a bit confusing, but it was a hard thing to focus in on the value of education, because growing up in my small community in Broome, because you were so indoctrinated in the church, it so dominated your life, both not just when you're at school, but also in every aspect of it. Imagine being at a very young age, you know, racing each other to dress up in skirts to serve on the altar for Mass, and going to Mass, you know, three times a day, you know, at times, it has a real impact and effect on you. The nuns, I think, provided us with a very good education base. I think going to Perth had its different dynamics and struggle, because we were exposed. Growing up in Broome, you kind of protected it a bit, because you live in your own environment, whatever the nature of the relationships then, which we were too young to fully appreciate or understand. But once you go to Perth, you're confronted fully with the racism that you have to deal with, and particularly in the schoolyard and the classroom. And so you spend your life growing through high school defending yourself, fighting off the intimidation from the teachers to other students, to people you interact with outside, in that, because you have a very closeted and very closed environment living on the mission, where you're not allowed to mix socially outside. It was kind of like the bastion of the kind of assimilationist structure that tried to tell you, you know, that we were somehow better than our own countrymen. And they tried to restrict our engagement with other Aboriginal people. You know, they tried to basically turn us into, we used to call it the school for super niggers, because there was special deportment classes, there was, you know, elocution lessons, there was ballroom dancing, there was all kinds of things trying to turn us into little white fellas. And of course, it was a very strict and deliberate regime, there's no doubt about it. And that, you can imagine, for a young black kid coming from a small town in the bush, as it was then, extremely traumatizing and challenging. So you didn't appreciate the value of education. Yet, you know, I can recall at year seven at primary school in Broome, the nuns teaching us Shakespeare. You know, we did Merchant of Venice and had to present that as a school play to the whole community in Broome at the end of the year. But that's something I do remember quite vividly. We were actually learning things. We were that type of education that was provided to us by the St. John of God nuns had a real sense of purpose and value. Because we were comfortable in our community, we were living at home, going to school in the daytime, we could, you know, and after school you play with your mates, and on the weekends you go fishing and hunting with your family. They were kind of natural things. But when you're taken out of that environment and you go to high school in Perth, and then you're in this, you know, base position dealing with racism at every turn, you don't measure the value of education. So I didn't, you know, I'd never really had a good education. I didn't even really finish year 12 in some ways. It's harder afterwards to learn to value it when you realize the limitations of not being able to do things you want to do after you have a more wider life experience.
And do you think that gave you the fire in your belly in your 20s and 30s that really made you the advocate that you are today?
I was really lucky because I sort of did my apprenticeship at Bush with the senior people who, after I left high school, I came back home, but I went back to Perth, but then trying to find a job. And then that was another disappointment where you couldn't get a job because you were black. There was a lot of jobs around. I suppose in some ways the advantage of the irony of it all is that you don't get a job and you wait a long time to get one. And the people who give you their job are usually going to be more than not, often than not, probably decent and good people. So therefore, you're probably lucky not to get those other kinds of jobs where you had to work in a very difficult situation, because, you know, Perth and Western Australia, you know, was and to some extent is, you know, a racist place. Well, certainly the systems is, and I think there have been some advancement and people are more enlightened these days, particularly the younger generations. It took a very, very, very long time. But going back to your question, I got a job working for the WA Museum recording Aboriginal sites. Actually, I didn't put in for the job. Somebody else put in the job for me and just got it. Because I came from the Kimberleys, it was just after the 1972 Aboriginal Heritage Act came into play. I took the job. It was a training job. I was working with senior traditional owners, Art Bush, recording public sites, mainly up in along the Gibb River Road, all the Wanjana sites, rock art sites, the whole range under the instructions and directions of those senior traditional owners. So I spent a fair bit of time out bush, walking out bush with those senior people. In some ways, what I call my apprenticeship. And I did go back to study for a while in Perth, but then I realised because I was working in the museum, I got an entry into a bridging course that was then called West Australian Institute of Technology, which is now Curtin University. And they credited me with some units, and I was doing some anthropology there. And I, you know, lasted one semester, and I said, this is absolutely crap. What am I doing sitting here listening to some white fellows teaching me about my own culture? So I upped and left, and I went home. I wanted to work back in my community.
So we are just going to take a break now, and we will come back and continue this yarn in just a moment.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, I'm Sharon Bessel. Policy Forum Pod is the podcast for those who want to dig a little deeper into the policy challenges facing Australia and its region. Each week, we bring together expert analysis to tackle the big issues facing our region and to propose policy solutions. It's insightful, it's positive, and it's always fun. Policy Forum Pod is out every Friday. You can find it on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. Or find us at policyforum.net/podcasts.
Welcome back. I'm Virginia Marshall, and I'm still here with Peter Yu having that great yarn. So, Peter, you've talked about travelling, you know, backwards and forwards from community, also looking at those early jobs that you once did, and also your first real adult experience of a white education that it wasn't what you really thought it would be. But it brings you to the Australian National University in a very high-profile role. And with a First Nations hub, the first of its kind, what is going to be your purpose, and why is First Nations education and networking, and especially your role, so important at this time?
Look, as I was explaining before, I had a pretty base education. I wouldn't say I had a great education. I think I probably learned a lot more from the old people I worked with, Art Bush, who took me basically in their trust. And I was very fortunate in that regard, having spent most of my early career working in the bush in different positions and being asked to represent you know, various different levels at an administration level, but at a representative level as well. I think I was elected to the National Aboriginal Conference in the early 80s. I think I was the youngest representative elected, but that was only because the community actually asked me to do that. I didn't have a clue or know what the NAC was, quite frankly. So that was another part of my education, understanding the kind of the politic of Aboriginal affairs as it was then and as it, you know, has been throughout my career. You know, in most cases, I was kind of thrown into the deep end. It's very fortunate to have some, you know, very good mentors But my understanding and learning has come from working with people, critically the senior cultural leaders and figures in the bush. I'm you know, eternally kind of grateful for them taking me under their wing and trusting me with that. And I guess part of my work is to repay that trust in a way, because it makes you angry, Virginia. You would know equally when you're working in those environments. You know, and mine was in the post pastoral award wages era in the early 70s, and taking people back on country and being confronted physically with obstruction from pastoralists and from miners, literally in very threatening kind of situations, taking people back away from the small towns, be it Fitzroy or Halls Creek or Derby or Broome or Connemara Wyndham, getting people back onto country in those early days. For a young person, you can't not understand from an education point of view how much you learn and how much you begin to understand the complete nuances of the public policy framework and in politic intentions of governments in trying to continue the subjugation and deny community the equity and the rights deserved after such a long and terrible history of marginalisation and dispossession that we've suffered. It becomes ingrained in you. It makes you very angry. As a young person, you want to lash out. You want to be able to, you get very passionate and emotional about things. And I think age, you know, like everybody else, tempers that to the extent where you think more strategically about how you confront those issues. I was surprised, actually, coming to the ANU. I was approached to see if I was interested in coming to the ANU and setting up the First Nations portfolio, given that I don't come from an academic background. And I always, you know, didn't have the educational levels as I thought you always have to have to get into university and stuff. And one of the things you reflect on is it would have been nice to have studied university and done something useful, but that didn't happen. But I think my life experience kind of has measured up to some degree to give me a knowledge base and an experience base that is different from what you would normally expect in an academic environment. But I think it's can be very useful to come from a different perspective. And I think that's what I'm trying to do here at the university, the ANU, is to look at uniquely the ANU as the national university and its inherent responsibilities for First Nation communities, development and progress. So how do you temper or target research that is meaningful and applicable towards advancing the course and the position of First Nation communities as part of, you know, the two ends of the spectrum, I suppose. One is the national policy position that deals with unresolved grievances and ongoing tensions between the nation state and us as the First Nation peoples of this country. And then again, how that what's the nature of useful research contribution towards tangible and manifest outcomes that leverage in a more contemporary environment? How do we navigate into the local and regional economy so that ultimately I think the value of is understanding how do we own that risk ourselves and break the nexus of the codependency relationship in my view, what is an ongoing colonial one, just how the administration in the Federation of this country operates between the Commonwealth and the state jurisdictions and its impact on our inability to develop a greater sense of social mobility and our ability to navigate and negotiate our strength and our positions into the economy. And I think that's particularly important now in a post-native title and land rights era where we have substantial assets, but we still lack the nature of our governance and management capability. So there's a gap to be closed there, which is building the competency. And I think the university can be a critical factor and player in helping to build the knowledge base, the capability and understanding environment and factors that as to how we might allow our people to be able to provide the enabling, not wait for any recognition or expectation, but take the opportunities and basically run with them.
Peter, you mentioned about Indigenous research. So how important is that role in your work with the First Nations Hub, really profiling and also ensuring that Indigenous research is a valued component of what you're doing?
Yeah, its official title is the First Nations Portfolio, and we have a development hub that sits under the portfolio. It's not an academic unit, and that's why I've tried to set it up differently as a business development hub. And there will be a learning and teaching hub that is towards working towards embedding the Aboriginal Studies curriculum and support for teaching of Aboriginal Studies across the campus at ANU. But research is critical. One of the reasons I decided to come and work at the ANU is I'd heard, this is fairly simplistic, I know, but in the mid-80s when Paul Keating and Bob Hawke introduced those fiscal reforms, taxation reforms, and floated the Australian dollar, that a lot of that work was done by the advice that came from senior economists in the ANU working, and others would, but I heard came from the ANU working with the finance department and treasury in terms of providing the analysis and the kind of the substantive kind of reasoning and justifications, and obviously they would have come from research and experience and knowledge of people in that space. But it provided government with the kind of reasoning and justification to make those important reforms. And I thought, well, if the ANU can do that, which altered the entire nature of the fiscal regulatory kind of regime in finance in Australia, surely the ANU can also do that for us as Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, that we've got economists, there are lawyers, there are social scientists, there are a whole range of subject matter experts across the university that do this research. And I thought, well, why couldn't they do that for us? Why couldn't they look at the question of compensation for Aboriginal people? Why couldn't they look at the question of agreement making? Why couldn't they look at the question of representation and mandate? Why couldn't they look at the question of the way that enhances the relationship but is inherently around nation building in the way that we manifestly deliver the kind of equity and the justice that's required in this country that we continue to evade us, you know, because the bottom line position in the political relationship is always how do we deny or stop Aboriginal people from attaining, you know, the equity and the justice so deserved. In answer to your question about research and its capacity to do things, that's not beyond us. And as a national university, in my own personal view, we have an inherent responsibility to promote those kinds of issues. On the other hand, you know, you've got to navigate this question of academic freedom about the individual researchers' interests and academics' interests in terms of their particular discipline or their interest as to how they go about that. But I think, to me, there's a sense of economic independence. There's the sense of duty of care. What are you doing research for? You know, you're doing research for your own benefit and growth and education and job prospects. That's all legitimate. There's nothing wrong with that. But I also think that there is a duty of care in respect to the what are you giving back to the community? How is this enhancing the nature of how we as a society can better ourselves, improve our circumstances, learn to understand our own experiences and to be able to, you know, generate a greater return for that investment? See, because in the ANU, you know, in 1946 when it was established, everybody knows it was established as part of the post-war reconstruction endeavour by the government and by people like Nugget Coombs and others. It was looking at industry, you know, manufacturing, looking at science and technology. But now 75 years later, in the year of our 75th anniversary in the ANU, we've achieved a lot in that direction. The ANU is the number one research institution in the country. But if you were to look at this from a kind of post or emerging COVID environment, a lot has moved away from those industry-based and manufacturing-based type of stuff. I mean, that's still important. Engineering is still important. But obviously it's much more high-tech these days. But people are looking more at health and well-being. People are looking about societal transformative issues. And I think that this is where the era is to make some leaps and bounds in research that gives us a better definition of where we sit within this, because, you know, we're all challenged by climate change. We all are trying to understand what our position is here, but and there's a huge debate going on of racism, you know, Black Lives Matter internally in Australia, the whole, you know, why is it left to the sporting codes to raise and promote the issue of racism and try and deal with that? Why isn't that a government responsibility, you know? And so I think we've now moved into an era where research is critically more important now for us. And I think what we haven't really done is understand the nature of the importance of data in research and how that can deliver real reform and change.
And that's a brilliant way to ask the last question in our yarn, Peter. And drawing on the strengths as you have through your whole life of community, of cultural bosses providing that strength and understanding, what do you see is the most important thing for an Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander person considering going to further education such as university?
Well, I know, this is a generalisation, but I think I know most of our young fellas coming through would say they want to, you know, have a successful career. But I think primarily what they would be saying is, I want to give back and help my people. It's a way, because, you know, being Black in this country, you can't help but think and do that. That's just you can't help but be political, because that's just a makeup of our history and our experience in colonization. We know we want to do that, but there are so many different facets of and areas in which that can be applied. But and it's important for people to achieve, you know, from an individual basis, to attain a level of qualification and reputation. And it's important for people to get good jobs, for them to enjoy good income, and then for them to have stable family lives, so that, you know, that's the basis of the rebirth of our society. But in that is the strength of the truth of our connection to country, our connection to our own people, our connection to the kind of understanding the real value sets, moving away from the rhetorical bubble, but understanding its true application of benefit to our community, and to analyze that, to think about that in a politic way. I don't mean be political. What I mean by thinking about it in a politic way is that, like Einstein said, you know, where there's an action, there's a reaction. It's about being more smart and clever about understanding about the nuanced position of what you say, what you do. How does that measure up, really? You know, these days, social media, people say whatever they want to do. There's no accountability. But what is the depth of that knowledge? What is the depth of that comprehension? What is the depth of that experience? Can sustain your argument, that can clearly distinguish you from others who might rely on social media. You know, it's not about us. It's not about us as individuals. It's about those of our community who are struggling through no fault of their own. It's about those of us who have sacrificed things before us to allow us to do what we're doing now. It's about paying our dues, you know, to the community. Certainly in my view anyway, I think that's has to be a major reason about why you want to achieve for yourself, which is all well and good, and you're entitled to. It's not inconsistent with giving back, but it's understanding how you can give back and what the value of your research is to that contribution.
Thank you, Peter, and thank you for sharing today. It's been really wonderful to have that yarn. And now, listeners, thanks so much for tuning in. We'd love to hear your thoughts, and you can reach us on Twitter at APPS Policy Forum or join our Policy Forum Pod Facebook group. We're looking forward to you joining the conversation. Mark will be back next week with another episode of Democracy Sausage. Stay safe, jira jira, and we'll see you then. Yin yamara.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.